You're listening to Real Technologies Track Talk podcast to guide you beyond the headlines with news, views, and insider truths from across the real industry. Welcome back to this episode of RTM's Track Talk podcast. And today we're going to be talking all about sustainability and the opportunities that are there in rail and potentially in areas in rail that we've not necessarily immediately thought about. I'm delighted to be joining these conversations by Chris Griffiths, Head of Product Sustainability at Marshalls. And we're going to really delve into not only what Marshalls do, but some of the sort of opportunities and processes that we can really come together as an industry and improve. But before we get into all of that, Chris, it's a delight to have you here. So I don't know if first off you just want to introduce yourself, what you do and what Marshalls do.
Good morning. Yeah, thanks for having me. As you say, I'm the head of product sustainability at Marshalls. We're the biggest hard landscaping manufacturer in the UK. So we manufacture and supply everything that you might need in the urban realm. And my job is to basically take all the great work that we do about sustainability at group level and translate that down to what it means for our customers, the people who are buying products from us. And the other part of my job is looking for the product opportunities, looking for the products that are going to help us to create more resilient spaces and more sustainable spaces going forward. So it's a really interesting place to be at the moment. We've been doing this for a long time, and all of a sudden the market seems to be catching up with us almost.
Yeah, definitely. It certainly, as you say, it's the perfect place to be at the moment, because it seems like those sort of aspects affect everything. And as we sort of think of rail, and I alluded to it in the introduction, we often think of rail having quite green credentials anyway, but there's a lot of opportunities, and particularly sort of, as you say, a lot of your work involves the urban realm, the sort of public realm space that is prevalent across our rail network. But what are sort of the real opportunities that we have there?
From our point of view, we have been long involved in rail projects, delivering the kind of largely the external works, the kind of the public realm spaces outside stations. We offer some products for some very specific products to rail platforms and some very specific products for sort of inside railway stations. But the majority of the work we do is about the car parks and the shared spaces that are outside the stations that help to make people want to use the space, enjoy using the space, and to keep them safe as well. But what we've been pushing for a long time, as I've said earlier, is that we can help to make these spaces as sustainable as they possibly can be by using materials, by understanding the right kind of materials, and then using the products in the right way to make the spaces as resilient as they can be.
Yeah, definitely. As you say, there's that opportunity, isn't there, that it's not just about making it a great place, because we want to make it a great place for people to go. Oftentimes we see these stations, they're sort of hubs within their communities, but being able to make those really sustainable as well, it gives that sort of that impression, that positive feeling for it. And that can encourage a lot of sort of further work on it.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, we're trying to encourage more and more people to use public transport, and that's clearly got to be a strategy to make the country, to bring the carbon emissions of the country down. And if we're going to do that, the outside spaces, the places outside these stations have got to be appealing and attractive and practical and usable. So we've been developing these products for a long time, but really it's more about what we do as a business to reduce our impact, which is what sort of translates through to the end user. And that's how they can really help to understand what the impact of the project is going to be. And we can help our customers to make the right choices by choosing the products that are that have the lowest embodied carbon, for example.
Definitely. And I suppose, as you touched on there and you did in your introduction as well, given the sort of experience Marshalls have in this and how it's been a core sort of part and vision of the company, the way that you have carried out the work that you do for a very long time, it kind of makes you a very well placed to be little bits of subject matter experts around that, which, as everybody in the industry suddenly has to shift, transition, and really ramp up the work they're doing there, I imagine it also gives you an opportunity to share that learning among the industry.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good place to be. First of all, we've been doing it for a long time. Sustainability's been at the heart of our agenda for more than two decades, really, longer than I've been with the business, certainly. What we've found as time's gone by is that a lot of people who who work with us now came to join Marshalls because of the work that we do in this sector, because, you know, people want to be a part of that and they want to contribute to that, and they want to be, they want to work for an organization that's doing things the best they possibly can. Just to give you some examples of that, we started working with the Carbon Trust way back in the late 2000s, and we started out by trying to understand what the carbon footprint of our individual products were. When we sat down to do that, there was no methodology for doing it. Various people were suggesting different processes, but we weren't the only company to have that idea at the time. I think Samsung and Tetra Pak were some of the bigger players that we were having these conversations with. So we helped the Carbon Trust to develop a process, a methodology, which is now featured in PAS 2050. And that's the kind of the industry standard method for arriving at a product carbon footprint. So we were certainly the first in the sector to launch product carbon footprints. We first published them in 2011. We revised them again in 2016. We're going through the process again now to update those numbers, because obviously with all the advances that we've made to reduce our carbon impact, we're seeing those carbon footprints reduce from where they were 5 years ago. So we'll be releasing that data very shortly. We're just crunching those numbers. The Carbon Trust are calculating those numbers for us now. So we're looking forward to seeing what they bring.
And sort of sticking with that wider sort of industry view that we're having at the moment, I suppose that's one of the challenges that sometimes will crop up in when organisations, those supplying or procuring sort of green goods, services, whatever it may be within the sector, being able to benchmark different products from different suppliers to one another when they may have different metrics that they're measuring their sustainability from. I imagine that's quite a consideration people have to have. And by the sounds of it, through sort of publication of these product carbon footprints and through having quite publicly available published data, it sounds like for at least Marshalls and potentially wider, that sort of transparency around it is a very big sort of thing, that standardization, isn't it?
Absolutely. That's what we've always been really keen to promote. Our stance has been that all we can do is be completely open and transparent about the impact that our products have. We use the standard methodology. The Carbon Trust calculate the numbers for us. So it's, we're not marking our own homework. Somebody else is calculating the numbers for us. And that is what gives our customers the confidence that, the data that we give them is credible. But you're absolutely right. Where it's a little bit frustrating at the moment, it feels a little bit like the Wild West in a lot of respects, because over the last 18 months to 2 years, the industry's really cut up and lots of people are doing really good things. But there's still quite a lot of confusion in the sector. So as you mentioned, it's very difficult, we think, for customers or procurement managers to compare like for like often. Because to give you an example there, we've always quoted full cradle to grave product carbon footprints. What that means is that the number that you see on our website or in our literature accounts for all of the emissions that are being created right from the material extraction, right at the start of the process, through the production of the process, through the packaging, and then through transport to site and the emissions used in installation, the emissions during use, even during the lifetime of the product, and even the emissions, the sort of estimated emissions at the end of life. So that's a true reflection, a genuine reflection of all the emissions that we would anticipate this product providing. And obviously there will be some estimates and some averages used in that, but that's why we use the Carbon Trust. So they're applying consistent sort of defendable averages and estimates. So that's the way we've always done it. But there are plenty of legitimate reasons why you might only quote a cradle to gate carbon footprint. So this is all about the boundary, the footprint boundaries. You know, where do you start measuring it and where do you stop measuring it? It's completely legitimate to use a cradle to gate footprint boundary. And that means you're just measuring the carbon used from material extraction through production to packaging. And then it's sitting at the factory gate waiting to be delivered. You know, depending on the manufacturer's or the supplier's business model, that might be a completely sensible way of doing it. But what we're finding is that people aren't necessarily being open and clear about what the footprint boundary is. So, and where that's frustrating, obviously a cradle to grave footprint boundary is going to be much higher than the cradle to gate boundary of exactly the same product, because necessarily it involves more emissions. So what we're really pushing towards, and what we're, you know, our sort of hobby horse at the moment, is to try to get some kind of understanding, some kind of consistency across the sector, so that people, first of all, they know what methodology is being used, they know who's calculated the numbers, and finally, you know, we've got to be clear about what footprint boundaries are being reported. Because, you know, it's absolutely reasonable, as I said earlier, to compare, you know, for somebody to get a cradle-to-gate footprint and for somebody else to provide a cradle-to-grave one. It depends how the business is set up, and it depends how complex the logistics are and all the rest. But as long as you know what the footprint boundary is, then you've got a chance to make fair sort of apples-for-apples comparisons. And at the moment, we're not seeing that. And that's something that can cause a few problems. Yeah, that's something that, while we're in this sort of slightly muddy phase of the sustainability development at the moment, there's still a lot of confusion in the market. So we're working with industry bodies to try and bring some clarity to that. But it's just something that we want to make procurement departments and customers fully aware of, really, just to make sure they know what they're asking for, and that when they do get some data, they know what they're getting.
I think that's such an interesting point you make throughout that, is that when we're talking about standardization of it all there, we're not talking about one size must fit all organizations, because as you rightly say, there might be two organizations in our sector who produce the same product, but one of them installs it and one of them doesn't, and there may be an entirely different procurement process for the installers that would impact all of that. It's about getting that standardization of the methodology, isn't it? Making that quite visible, reliable, and so people can make that more informed decision.
Yeah, that's absolutely what it's about. Just to cite you an example, one of our products was up against an alternative product about 6 months ago, and the alternative product had about half the carbon footprint of ours. I think ours was about 34 kilograms per meter. Theirs was about 17 kilograms per meter. And that's fine. You know, we'll stand back. We're not saying that we're always the best, but what we are saying is that we're transparent and we're clear about it. And frankly, when that happens, that's a rocket for us to sharpen our pencil and, you know, to go back to the R&D and find out what we can do. What happened with that situation was that when we interrogated it a little closer, we found out that the alternative product was being manufactured in mainland Europe. So the number that was being quoted was a cradle to gate one. So by the time it got to the factory gates in mainland Europe, had 17 kilograms. Our cradle to grave number of a UK manufactured product that included all the emissions over its lifetime was 34. Just a quick calculation on our behalf by the Carbon Trust suggested that by the time you'd brought that product over to the UK and then applied all the rest of the sort of lifetime use emissions, you'd be looking at well in excess of 38, 39, 40 kilos per meter for that product. So it's not that anybody's lying. It's just that there is a lack of consistency in reporting sort of methodology, and some people are being deliberately disingenuous, if I'm being honest. You know, so that some people just don't understand it. Lots of people are doing it completely openly and transparently and doing it well. But, you know, we are seeing a few examples where people are being deliberately disingenuous and, you know, just trying to get a short-term competitive advantage. And, you know, when we've been doing this for so long and, you know, having read all the reports that have come out over there, well, you know, particularly the reports that have been coming out recently, it's more important than competitive advantage. You know, we have to be doing things properly, and we have to be doing things the best we can if we're going to make the kind of impact, the kind of difference that we need to make in order to reduce the impact of climate change.
Certainly, and I think that's the really sort of important point that this all comes back to, isn't it? That when we're having these conversations, when we're talking about situations like that, where it's about informing people so that they know that, is there a full process, is there just purely the production process? It's not necessarily because all of the various sort of alternate options are competing and wanting that competitive advantage. It's because we want to know the whole impact, because then we can better measure, we can better impact, because dealing with climate change, the impacts we're going to see within the sector, is going to involve collaboration from everyone. And therefore, we need the information, don't we?
And that's exactly it. We did as I said at the start, we like to think we're really good at this because we've been doing it for a long time. We've been, you know, engaging with the experts and we've been understanding what the issues are. We reduced our carbon footprint as a business between 2008 and 2020. We reduced our carbon footprint by 50%, which is massive, especially if you consider the growth that we've undertaken during that period. So, as you know, we're confident that we know what we're talking about, but we called it our carbon challenge a month or so ago. And it's a sort of call to action for everybody else in the sector to really be honest and sort of share the numbers and, you know, share those with us, share those with the market, because that's a challenge to us as well, because I'm on the inside of it. And although we do loads of really good stuff, I bet there are some people out there who are doing really good work who are really reducing their carbon emissions, or just quite naturally because of the way they do business, doing it better than us maybe. And if they report those numbers, as I said, that's a real sort of challenge to us to go back and to sharpen our pencils and to sort of go back to the research labs and look to what we can do to improve our sustainability performance as well. But you're right, collaboration's exactly what it's all about. And we talk about, you know, it's a cliche, isn't it? Everybody talks about that, and we've talked about that in every meeting everybody's been to for the past sort of 20 years. But it's never been more important now. We find we do a lot of research and a lot of development into bringing products to market. So we'll do a lot of research in the first place to make sure there's a need and a requirement, and then we'll do a lot of work to develop it and to test it and get it to a certain stage. But there's always that moment where we have to say, right, we can do so much and we can put so much resource into it, but now we need a client or a customer or a willing partner to sort of take it on board and to install it and to sort of take that, to share the risk with us, if you like. We can drive as much risk out of it as we possibly can through our development process, but there will always be an element of risk when you're launching something new on the market. Where we've, you know, for a long time, that kind of risk, the risk-averse nature of the construction sector has, I suspect, sort of slowed down some of the more, yeah, the more exciting potential developments, because there's been a lack of willingness to sort of share that risk with us. But we're in a space now where we can't afford not to take risks. And that's, you know, as a business, that's what we're doing. And to be honest, that's what we're hearing from our customers and our partners as well. And that's why it's really exciting, because there is this sort of understanding, certainly people who work in the construction sector, there's this understanding that we really have to do things differently, and we can't afford to just, you know, do what we did last week. Yeah, that's not an option. So yeah, I mean, it's certainly an exciting place to be. But again, that's a call out to sort of customers and people that want to work with us and that we want to work with, to say, you know, if you've got any specific ideas or specific needs or particular requirements for a project or a job, then yeah, we'd love to sort of hear from you, and we'd love to sort of see if we can work together on ideas.
I think that's such a big point of all of this, is that, as you say, sustainability is not a new conversation. It's a conversation that's going on, as we say, for 20 years and beyond 20 years. And within that, it's covering very large sectors that have a lot of people in and a lot of amazing ideas. It's just that we've now gone from a lot of the conversation phases, where it was an additional element to things, to now it's the period of action. I think when we were talking in the preamble, setting this up, we were just saying that the sort of mitigation phase is kind of been accepted now. We know that we have to take action to impact climate change. And I suppose the next conversations that will be starting to happen, and probably already, is how we also adapt for the bits and pieces that are going to now be in our society, that are going to affect our sort of sector. We've seen in the recent reports, things like more extreme weather, flooding, challenges like these, even with mitigation, they're not going to disappear. It's not going to be that reversal, is it? So I imagine there's now a sort of conversation around how we take the next steps as well, how we do that adaptation.
That's exactly it. And that's where we're at. All of the work that we've done, and all the great work that the industry is doing to reduce its carbon emissions, is all about mitigating the worst effects of climate change. The more we can reduce a carbon, the less sort of reaction we're going to see from climate change. But we have to accept that things are changing, because we can see they're changing now. You know, you look at all the massive flood incidences, but the, you know, on the other side of that, you see the incidences of drought on the other side. Weather change, climate change, is actually, you know, it's absolutely happening. You know, the data will back that up. You know, whether you choose to believe that it's man-made or not, you know, it is. But what you can't sort of walk away from is the fact that climate change is happening. So we're going to get more extreme rainfall. It's going to rain more intensely for longer periods of time, more frequently. We're going to get longer, hotter droughts. We're going to get, you know, much hotter weather in the summer. So we have to learn how to design spaces that are going to be resilient to those kind of things. So the mitigation piece is all about reducing carbon and reducing the impact. But you're absolutely right. The adaptation piece is an understanding of and an acceptance that climate change is happening. We can't, yeah, there are things that were too late to reverse. So that being the case, what are the products that we can make? What are the systems that we can design? And what are the philosophies that we can adopt that will mean that our cities are still comfortable to live in and work in and play in 25, 50 years time? Because, you know, the city centres, you know, UK city centres are going to look very different in 50 years than they do today. They're going to have to. So there's two sides of that. You know, how do you new build stuff is always, I'd say it was easier. I'd love to think it's easy. It's not always easy, but it's, you know, it's more straightforward to build these kind of ideas into new build projects. But with existing, yeah, there's going to be an awful lot of retrofit, an awful lot of adaptation, a lot of, you know, retrofit of different technologies to make these spaces. But what it comes down to, Matt, really, it's bringing nature back into urban spaces. So that's, yeah, treating water as an asset, getting water in these spaces, getting more green infrastructure into these spaces. So there's, you know, a green infrastructure provides so many benefits in terms of not just sort of water management, but biodiversity benefits, health benefits, mental health benefits. It keeps dust down. It provides shade. You know, it cleans the air. It cools the air. So all, you know, so getting green infrastructure, reconnecting with nature and bringing natural resources back into city centres, that's got to be the way the market is going. So we've got to understand that. We've got to sort of develop the products and the systems that are going to make that easy for our customers to adopt and put into place. So that's, yeah, it's an exciting place to be. Things are changing very fast.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, as we say, the sort of adaptation mitigation thing, I remember once someone I was speaking to described it quite aptly, given the sector we're talking about today, as a train, and the mitigation is the train brake, where you still travel along the track till you stop. But I know, yes, as we discussed there, the idea that bringing in this green space, this green infrastructure, well, rail particularly has a great opportunity for that, because particularly in our sort of cities, in our urban areas, we're becoming sort of more densely populated more and more and more. And well, that leaves limited space, shall we say, for introducing this green infrastructure, particularly in existing areas already built up. But a train station, areas like that, they tend to have quite a sort of footprint in that area that is of a slightly lower size of development.
So yeah, no, I think that's it. If you think about a train station, and you think about, you know, walking up to a train station or parking your car outside a train station, then walking into the walking up to the platform, if you can make that space as appealing as possible, and if you can, you know, put open water in it, and you can manage the surface water so there are no puddles and so it's dry and safe. But if you can also cram in wherever you possibly can, if you can cram in trees to give you canopy cover and shrubs and bushes to provide all the biodiversity benefits, first of all, it just makes it a nicer place to be, a nicer place to look at, and, you know, something that, but the other advantage is that it becomes something, somewhere that people actually want to sort of hang around. Yeah, yeah. People want to stay there, and the retail opportunities that you can put in at train stations. I was talking to somebody in Scandinavia the other day, and they were talking about a project that they'd done where they put in a small rain garden just on the corner of a street. It's a bit of an experiment, really. So I had a couple of trees and a couple of bushes, and it just so happened that it was outside a cafe, a long established cafe in the center of Copenhagen. The owner of the cafe came out when they came out to sort of monitor it and have a look at it 6 months after it had been installed, and he was over the moon with it. He was saying how much, you know, his takings had gone up something like 80% in the 6 months since it had been installed, because all of a sudden, if you install, you know, if you create the spaces and make them resilient. All of these green infrastructure things, it's doing a job. But they're also just creating the kind of space that people want to hang around in. And, you know, when people are hanging around, they're spending money as well. So it's kind of a, it does feel like a no-brainer. But, you know, I've worked for a company that supplies the construction industry. And I suppose it is a little bit, it's easy to say it's a no-brainer. But for a long time, you know, we've been very busy leaving the green stuff to the landscape architects and to the horticulturalists. But I think we need to sort of bring those things together now. And, you know, we again, it's all about collaboration, isn't it? If we work together on these things, we can create. Our tagline is creating better spaces, right? And that's exactly what we're about. You know, not just in terms of how they look or how they work, but how they function as well and what benefits they provide. So, you know, if we can collaborate to bring those kind of elements, then we've got a really good chance of making more resilient spaces that are going to stand up to the challenges of the next 30 or 40, 50 years and on.
No, absolutely. And I think that encompasses the whole idea of rail as well, that often the infrastructure that we deliver, it takes time to deliver that. We're an industry that is quite used to the changes we make today, seeing the impacts in 10, 20, 30 years. And I think that really positions we're in a place where making these sort of green infrastructure changes, making a lot of the sustainability change, is not going to be a strange new concept to us. We're not going to expect immediate results. We're an industry that's well-versed with seeing the gradual improvements as it goes. I think in terms of sort of, because I'm conscious that we've already kept you for so long today, I could talk for hours and hours and hours about this stuff. I think it's fascinating and we can hear the sort of passion that you have in it as well, Chris. But first off, because we've talked about collaboration quite a bit, I want to ask if anyone listening to this who's found it as beneficial as I have wants to reach out to yourself or to Marshalls, where would they be best served to do that?
Well, drop me a line by all means, chris.griffiths@marshalls.co.uk. If you want to find out more about the work that we do, you know, there's the sustainability section on our website, which is packed full of the accreditations we've got. We're like the scouts, you know, we like a badge, so we, you know, we work hard to make sure we've got all of the you know, all the badges we can, because we make sure other people are marking our homework. And you can also see the stuff that we're thinking about as well. This is stuff that we're not necessarily doing yet, and the stuff that we might not end up doing, if we're being honest. But if you have a look on the sustainability part of the website, you can see all the stuff we've done and what we're going to do as well, because although we've taken great steps, we know we've got loads more to do, and we've had commitments to reduce our carbon footprint even further. We've had those commitments approved by the Science Based Targets Initiative. We were certainly the first business in our sector to do that. I think we still are the only business in our sector to have the commitments approved. So that's your sort of evidence that we're not sitting on our laurels and we're still striving to push things down even further.
Amazing. So positive to hear as well, the idea that it's not just all of the amazing work that's been done and then we're accepting that, but still striving with the same energy that we've had for the last 20 years to improve as well. As I say, Chris, it's been an absolute delight to have you on today. So thank you so much for taking the time. I'm sure it has been as useful to our audience as has been enjoyable for me listening and talking to you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of RTM's Track Talk podcast. Join the conversation on social media or get in touch with the link on our website. To stay up to date with all the latest news and episodes, subscribe and give us a rating on whatever streaming service you are using. This has been Rail Technology Magazine's Track Talk podcast. Thanks for listening and we'll see you next time.